Good afternoon. This is Saturday, October 5th, 2002. I'm your host, Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review, bringing you the live webcast, The LaRouche Show, for this week. This week, giving the briefing will be John Hoeffel, one of the senior economics reporters for EIR, and later on in the show, Edward Spanis, the law editor of EIR, will also be briefing us on some incredibly explosive information about Iraq, the Bush family, and the violations of international law that are represented by George Bush, or as he calls him, Bush 43's resolution to the United Nations Security Council. Over the past week, there have been some very, very serious developments. What's coming out of the administration right now is the Sharonization of U.S. policy and a drift away from the American intellectual tradition to one of the most evil traditions that the human race has seen over history, the Roman imperial model. This came out in two documents from the administration over the last 3 weeks. One was the National Security Strategy for the United States in 2002, which for the first time in the history of the Republic has adopted a proposal of preemptive war, not a preventive strike, not a preemptive strike where you see a gunman down the street headed right towards you and you take action before he kills you. That's one kind of preemptive action. What we're talking about is a doctrine of preemptive war. When I say the Sharonization of U.S. policy, what we have right now is a configuration in the United States and Israel working together of a particular form of Zionist fascism that goes back to Vladimir Jabotinsky, a right-wing Zionist admirer of Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, who killed, maimed, and attacked many other of the early leaders of what became the State of Israel, and was an unabashed fascist. His followers today are Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and a nest of operatives inside the United States who have basically seized control of Vice President Cheney's office through Louis Scooter Libby, Cheney's chief of staff, wherever Cheney is in his undisclosed location, and a group inside the Pentagon. What has been coming out in terms of the national strategy of the United States from the White House, the document that was submitted to Congress demanding a resolution that gives the presidency a blank check for any war, anywhere, anytime, not just Iraq? That's the second document. The third document is a UN resolution which is described as a complete violation of international law. Let me preview the coming issue of Executive Intelligence Review and also EIW, the Electronic Intelligence Weekly. Let me urge people to try out these publications and to subscribe and to ask questions. Previewing this coming week's publications is an article by counterintelligence editor Jeffrey Steinberg called A Decision to Stop War from Which LaRouche Did Not Shrink. Steinberg opens this article saying the recent behavior of President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, specifically the formulations presented by the two in draft resolutions before the Congress and the United Nations Security Council on the pending preemptive war on Iraq, manifest clinical insanity. This judgment was stated urgently on October 3rd by presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche, who challenged any other explanation for what the president and the vice president are doing. Bush and Cheney are launching a war of aggression in violation of the U.S. Constitution and in violation of post-World War II codes of international law, including the Nuremberg precedents, the London Charter of 1945, and the UN Charter. The type of preemptive invasion of Iraq being advocated by Bush and Cheney is precisely the kind of war crime for which 12 defendants were convicted at the Nuremberg trials of 1945. The principles of law recognized in the judgments of that first Nuremberg tribunal were adopted by the UN General Assembly in 1950. This is the cornerstone of the post-World War II order, centered around relations among sovereign nation states. Could a president of the United States, LaRouche asked, who was not insane, proceed with such reckless abandon to violate these principles of law which have been the foundation of the post-war international order? Let's look at a couple of developments from this week to tell you why it's insane. You had a development in Vienna midweek where the chief of the UN inspection team, Mr. Hans Blix, who dismantled the Iraqi nuclear capability between 1992 and 1998, secured from the government of Iraq a blank check for inspectors to go into Iraq. This has been rejected by the White House as a trick. Who is the nuclear armed threat to the world at this point? What Lyndon LaRouche is saying is the emperor has no clothes. There's a secret agenda. The White House has gotten every demand in terms of inspections, disarmament, etc. What's that real agenda? We'll be talking about that, answering your questions, and hearing from Ed Spanas. Right now, the only way to understand this kind of insanity is to understand how desperate this Anglo-American empire faction is. They are losing control of the world because they have lost control of the economy. This is Michelle Steinberg with The LaRouche Show, and I'd like to now introduce our economics reporter, John Hoeffel, who has an article in this coming EIR entitled, LaRouche Called It, Hellish September for the Global Economy. Hi, John. How you doing?
Just fine, Michelle.
You start out saying the month of September was a wake-up call for all those citizens and policymakers who have been merely watching rather than joining the LaRouche movement. Tell us about Lynn's forecasts and what happened in this month from hell, as a lot of the brokers have called it.
Well, on August 24th, Lynn made the statement, I believe on this on the radio show, that September was going to be a month of horror in the markets, that things were just collapsing. And then at his national conference speech on August the 31st, he reiterated that comment, stating that September was going to be a hellish month. That basically what you have is you have a continuation of a plunge in the economy, which is now escalating. And as everybody saw in September, you know, the markets around the world plunged. Now, there's a lot more than just the markets that are plunging, but you saw the stock markets plunging. The global stock markets basically have been cut in half over the last couple of years. You know, the Dow started, the bottom fell out of the Dow. It's now down below where it was after this 9/11, and despite periodic minor little interventions by the plunge protection team, it just continues to crash. So September really sort of was the final nail in the coffin of those people who were pushing this idea of a recovery. But it's not happening. You know, we were supposed to have it in the first quarter. We didn't. We were supposed to have it in the second quarter. We didn't. We were supposed to have it in the third quarter. Things just keep getting worse every quarter. I mean, there is no recovery. And I think in order to situate how Lynn understood this, you go back to, well, I mean, when you discuss how Lynn understands these things, it's hard to put a start point on it because he sort of looks through the
Right.
broad sweep of history. But if you take 1997 as a point at which things started to seriously blow up.
Now, 1997, that's what most media call the Asia crisis, right?
Yes,
Okay.
just prior to the Asia crisis was a London derivatives crisis, which sort of gets left out. This was at the time when there was talk of this $55 trillion horror, and one of the British fund managers, a guy named Tony Dye, was warning that the derivatives markets could blow up. And basically he got fired. And but in
Not
fact,
politically correct,
not
I'd say.
politically correct,
Right.
but within a couple of months of that is when George Soros launched the currency warfare against Asia, which was called the Asian currency crisis. That it was an assault on the Asian currencies in order to steal enough money out of Asia to plug the hole back home in London. Now, the effects of going out with such a brutal targeted looting of what was at that point the fastest growing part of the world economy was to hit the world economy in a way that it has not recovered from yet.
So
So,
we're now 5 years hence from that crisis, which was papered over with a bubble.
right. But you had the looting of Asia that went on in 1997 and in 1998. In 1998, you had the Russian default because Russia was being looted similarly. So Russia defaulted, devalued the ruble, caught the markets off guard, sent the whole global financial system into a panic. There was a near meltdown of the system. I mean, if you look at some of the discussions that went on in G7 meetings and things like that, people were talking about being right on the edge. The way they decided to get out of that was through what George Soros called the wall of money. Just flood the market with liquidity, flood it with promises, flood it with basically do whatever has to be done to get this economy, to get the financial side of things moving again. Out of that came the NASDAQ bubble. The dot-com bubble, the growth of all of these dot-coms, was basically a part of this wall of money approach. The growth of the telecoms, which was related to the dot-com growth, was also part of this wall of money approach. This was the bailout.
Now, I have a question. There were 11 interest rate cuts in the year 2001, which was part of this wall of money strategy. This was supposedly going to take care of the Brazil crisis, which it did not. The Argentina crisis was not helped by this, and it certainly didn't help the US economy. So how come it didn't work anymore?
The reason why it doesn't work anymore is because we've had a phase change in the bubble. We're now in a period where you have a combination of hyperinflation in certain financial assets and deflation in other financial assets. For example, you have a savage deflation in world stock markets.
Up to 97%, for example, in the German
Yes, they're
new market.
disbanding the new market because it's basically disappeared.
Okay, let's stay on that for a minute, just so that our listeners, especially people on our weekly organizers conference call, who I'm going to take the first questions from in a few minutes, think about this. The German new market, as I understand it, is about equivalent to the NASDAQ, the technology index in Wall Street.
Yeah, and it's smaller, but in composition, it's the same,
In
reflects the
composition,
same
right.
thing.
So imagine if there was an announcement that in February of next year, the NASDAQ would go out of business completely. You begin to get an inkling of the panic that could be unleashed in this whole, in this whole situation, and why the Anglo-American Empire is on a mad dash for war. Some of Bush's insane advisors have told him, Mr. President, you need a war to turn everybody's attention away from the economy. This has worked in the media, but let's look at some of these figures, John. This is from your article coming up in the IR. This is what happened in the month of September. You estimate that the value of U.S. corporate equities fell some $2.3 trillion during the third quarter alone, of a total loss of about $9 trillion since the market began falling in 2000. I have two questions about this. All of the media is saying the third quarter ended, it was the worst crash since October 1987, and give us an idea of what those figures actually mean in real terms and how it affects people's living, mortgages, etc. And also, why is October 1987 not just an ordinary date?
Okay, in terms of what impact this has on people, I mean, part of the problem is that this stock market valuation was all fictitious. I mean, it wasn't real money. It was monopoly money. These things rose, but there was no real economic underpinning for the rise. It was just a rise in speculation. However, if you go back to say that we're just going back to the way it was in 1997 or so, and that was okay, so we're okay now, is to misunderstand what's going on at the same time. Because you've had an enormous, most people play with leverage. In the markets, everybody plays on leverage. You borrow money. So if you borrowed money to buy stocks and you lose money on your stocks, you lost the money you invested and you lost the money you borrowed. You still have to pay back the loans. So this whole question of leverage adds a layer into this that a lot of people don't think about. Also, people who borrowed on their credit cards to buy stocks during the height of the NASDAQ boom.
Right.
A lot of people have been wiped out. A lot of people who got into the market late during this boom have simply been wiped out. Not only are their investments wiped out, but a lot of them have lost their jobs. If they were in the dot-com world or in the telecommunications business or in things that were feeding off of that, they've lost their jobs. So imagine if you lose your investment nest egg, or if your pension was involved, invested in one of these companies, or if it was your job. You have a lot of people who lost just about everything they had in this. You also have the effect on everybody of this evaporation of wealth, because you will see, even though it hasn't really hit yet, you're going to see a decline in real estate values, for example, in your home. You know, the value of your home is going to go down dramatically over the next few years. It may happen very quickly. But anything that was propped up by this bubble, a lot of fictitious capital, homes, investments, and pensions, other things like that, are also vaporizing, just as the market in general is vaporizing. I mean, what's the difference between a GE pension and an Enron pension? The answer is only a matter of time. And now what we're beginning to see, we've seen the companies go broke. We've seen these company scandals. But what we're beginning to see now is the meltdown of the banking system.
Okay, let me ask a question about that. Are the banks sound?
No.
Okay. All right. You gave us a briefing a couple of weeks ago. I'd like you to elaborate. When I say us, John gave us a briefing at our EIR staff weekly review about some of the biggest banks in the country. Is it possible for the Federal Reserve to secretly take over the banks and not tell the public and not even the depositors? We think that's going on. What are the ramifications of this?
Well, it is possible. It was done in 1989 when the Federal Reserve secretly took over Citicorp, which was bankrupt, and nursed it back to health through a lot of funny measures. So it's been done before. It was done in 1989. Now, I think that J.P. Morgan Chase blew up last year and has been secretly taken over by the Fed last year and has been run ever since by the Fed, and that Citicorp probably blew up earlier this year and is now being run by the Fed, and that I guess the real question is Bank America now in line? There were rumors that they had received some sort of federal life support. These are the three biggest derivatives banks in the country, and they're all bankrupt. So the answer is yes, I think the Fed is running them. I think the Fed has largely taken over the top derivatives banks and is doing everything it can do to unwind the derivatives disaster and keep it hidden from the public. And I think that's one of the reasons why Alan Greenspan continues to insist that no one should look at the derivatives market.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. I have as my guest today John Hoeffel, Senior Economics and Banking Reporter for EIR. John Hoeffel has just been speaking about the banking crisis that is hitting the country, which is being kept under wraps, and if it were known, would have a devastating effect on the elections, which are 4 weeks ago. We're in a race for time, as Mr. Lyndon LaRouche said on this show on August 24th, one of those incredible forecasts that he made about the month of September that is now being quoted around the world. This week, in doing our EIR evaluations and strategy in terms of how we can intervene to provide the public, the United States Congress and Senate, with the information they need, with the questions that they need, the philosophy behind this war drive and the psychology behind it, Mr. LaRouche made an interesting observation. He said, let's just tell the truth and talk really tough about this situation. The United States is bankrupt. And right now, George W. Bush, Bush 43, doesn't have the money to buy an airplane ticket to send those troops over to Iraq to have a war. And this will destroy the economic situation in the United States and lead to a 30-year war. This is the kind of crisis that we're in. John Hoeffel just touched on it with an incredible warning that two of the largest banks in the world, J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank, are in a situation where they may have already been secretly taken over by the Federal Reserve because they have gone way beyond solvency. This is the kind of reality that we're going to have to get through to our fellow citizens. Let me ask you a quick other question, John, before we have to go to announcements. This past week, there was a IMF World Bank jamboree in Washington. And the same week, it was announced that Alan Greenspan was benighted, or no, he was knighted by the Queen of England. He's now Sir Alan Greenspan. I think that was the propaganda side of it. But any comments on the IMF World Bank meeting in Washington, and compare that to what Lynn's saying about the new Bretton Woods?
Well, the IMF World Bank meeting, all they showed is, again, that they are morally and intellectually bankrupt as well as financially bankrupt. They're trying to continue to squeeze blood out of a turnip. Mm-hmm. Their whole approach is, we're going to find some way to make these countries pay. And the fact of the matter is, these countries can't pay.
Who's on the chopping block?
Brazil.
Right?
Brazil. Argentina is melting down. Brazil is on the chopping block. They're trying to pressure Brazil into paying the debt. But the money's not there. The problem they have is the money is simply not there, and there is no way to make them pay. And the IMF won't, because if they admit that this is true, they admit that the system is bankrupt. So they won't admit it. So they continue to go through all of these motions and have all of these fights. But it's, on the one hand, it's important because these people are killers. The IMF system is a deadly system.
Right.
On the other hand, they're irrelevant because they have no solution. There's nothing they can do that can work. And you contrast that with Lynn, who starts off by saying, let's admit that they're bankrupt. And now let's solve the problem. Let's write off all of this paper that can't be paid, have a global redevelopment plan to actually start building up the real economy and produce our way out of this mess. You know, one way is more cannibalism, the other way is more production. And the IMF is clueless.
When we come back from the brief announcements that I'm going to make, we're going to do two things. Ask John to give us an update on the developments of the new Bretton Woods financial system, which was adopted in a form by the Senate of Italy last week, and also discuss LaRouche's infrastructure program for the United States, which we're going to make in the next 4 weeks the riding question, overriding question for every elected official who wants to get reelected or elected for the first time. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live on the web on Saturdays from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening live from the United States, you can call us toll free at 1-866 857-4327. That's 1-866-857-4327. International callers can reach us at 703-443-8419. The LaRouche Movement publishes a number of publications: Executive Intelligence Review, our weekly magazine. We also publish the New Federalist newspaper. We have an electronic weekly publication called Electronic Intelligence Weekly, EIW, which comes up every Monday afternoon. To find out more about these publications, call us at 1-888-347-3258. Or visit our website at www.larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. You can also visit our website to download archived programs, read a transcript, or get further information about the LaRouche movement. I would particularly recommend the LaRouchePub.com homepage and the international links, where among the language translations that we have of Lyndon LaRouche's major writings and other extraordinary pieces from EIR, you could read them in Arabic, French, Italian, German, and other major European languages, and of course Spanish. So please get in touch with us anytime during the week at 1-888-347-3258. Okay, going back to John, we have, my goodness, a huge lineup of questions for you. Why don't you speak a couple of minutes about Lynn's infrastructure program that we've been working on getting adopted, and the new Bretton Woods?
Okay. The essence of the infrastructure program is that you have to solve our economic problems, you have to build your way out. And that you build your way out by using the science and technology you implement new technologies to give a sort of a shockwave through the economy. Now, one of the things that we placed a great deal of emphasis on is the transportation infrastructure. Because if you look at our transportation system right now, you have the West Coast ports are shut down due to a lockout.
Good point. $2 billion a day, something like that, right?
You have the Amtrak, the national rail system, on the cutting block. And you have the airline industry going bankrupt.
Right.
So this is a disaster. And it's all the more so since we've adopted this just-in-time approach to everything. So what we have to do is, one way to solve this problem is to start rebuilding this infrastructure with trains. You want to use maglev trains, magnetically levitated trains, and use that to replace a lot of the air traffic. For example, there's no reason for people to fly between Washington and New York City if they could take a high-speed train, an actual high-speed train, as opposed to the things we have now, which slow down at some places to 20 miles an hour.
Right.
With the air traffic, we have to cut back air traffic. We don't need to do as much flying if we build these maglev systems. But we also have to save the airlines. We have to save our air infrastructure, which doesn't mean bailing out the stockholders of the airlines, but it means saving the physical assets and saving the infrastructure. We have to build up Amtrak. We have to go back more towards rail. We have to continue to improve our water infrastructure. For example, the barge traffic in places on the Missouri River is almost grinding to a halt. So you have to do all that sort of thing, and then you can take that same approach and apply it to other areas of the economy. You have, water systems, sewer systems that have to be rebuilt and improved. The whole physical side of the economy has been collapsing under the weight of the looting from this parasitic financial system.
So these great projects would be financed by public and a combination of public and private, but if we really want to jumpstart the economy, there's nothing wrong with dirigism. It's not communism, right?
No, it's not. I mean, the way you start these things is through government credit. Just like Alexander Hamilton laid out, just like is laid out in the Constitution of the United States, you have government-directed credit. The government foots the bill for these things because the development projects like this return more, and they return a profit to the economy. You get more out of them than you put into them.
Like the space
Like
program.
the space program was at $14 in results for every, in output for every dollar you put in. All right, that's the sort of thing you want to fund. And if you improve the infrastructure, you improve the way the economy works, you start rebuilding our manufacturing base. That's the way to turn this whole thing around. You build your way out. And you build your way out by jumping up to the highest levels of technology that you have. You put those into place now, and then you have your scientists working on higher levels of technology to replace those, so that you're continually upgrading the technological base, which means you continually upgrade the population. Because it's the kids who you teach in school now who will come out and make those developments for you, make the breakthroughs for you.
Wow, this is John's addressing. Every time we get into this question of the infrastructure development, it really raises the full cultural question of education and the fact that youth today have been told in every which way, from television, Hollywood, their families, their baby boomer parents, and so forth, that they're the no future generation, and we're out to give them a future, actually. In many cases, it's the young people who are leading the rest of the population because they don't have the delusions that the baby boomers have. John, we have about four calls, questions lined up. I'm going to start with the conference line and go to Scott from South Jersey, who is on the organizers' conference line. Scott, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Very well, go ahead.
Okay, I have two questions. I'll make them quick. From what I understand, the controlled disintegration plan initiated by Paul Volcker envisioned the destruction of the American economy. So I am wondering why the utopians, why the elites are so panicked and scrambling if, in fact, they're seeing the outcome that that policy envisioned? And or are they panicked because they didn't expect it to get away from them so much? My second question is, if the speculative bubble in the stock market was exactly that, fictitious, how were people able to cash in at high stock rates at the height of the bubble and actually be able to turn those fictitious stock values into real cash, like a lot of people did, and a lot of people made a lot of money?
Okay. John, why don't you go ahead?
Okay, to start with the question of pulling money out of the stock market. I mean, you know, in any pyramid scheme, people can pull money out. You can make money in the derivatives market, which is a bigger bubble than the stock market. You can place a few bets. You can make some money, sell things off. You can get out and you can pull cash out of it, and they do. They make a lot of money off of trades and other things like that. The problem is that you can't ever cash out the bubble.
Fully, right.
You know, not everybody can't get out. So you can bleed a little bit around the edges. You can take a little bit out here and there. But ultimately, the whole thing is going to blow up. So, yeah, people who sold their stocks and took that cash, they've got the money. They've got it for a little while anyway. But even then, that's somewhat of an illusion, because what happens when the economy blows up? No, you pull your cash out of the stock market and you invest it in real estate. And then your real estate blows up. So people can pull money out, but the bubble itself, you can never get out of the bubble. The only way for a bubble to end is to blow up. All right. Now, in the case of the controlled disintegration of the U.S. economy, I mean, we have had the disintegration of the U.S. economy. We have turned this economy into a rentier-financier economy, which is run by speculation. It's an imperial economy at this point. So the question is, in my mind, I think it's somewhat of an open question, is do they want to actually blow up the United States completely and have it collapse and disappear, or were they really out to just co-opt the U.S. economy and make it part of the empire? I mean, but I think that the economy has disintegrated. It has been taken over by this oligarchic outlook, and it is dying because of it.
Well, I'd like to add another aspect of why the utopians are panicked. And you can't really understand their panic without looking at the where Lyndon LaRouche is in this whole configuration. And that is, the utopians are not upset that people are losing a lot of money. Scott, you're absolutely right about that. They are not panicked at all that that the United States, as an economic city on the hill, if you will, is going under and we're losing the general welfare. That's perfectly fine with them. They like genocide. They'd like to reduce the world's population and go back to a oligarchic elite. What they are panicked about is that if they cannot control the population's rebellion against the delusions that have been foisted on them, which would not be a problem for them if it were not for LaRouche and the LaRouche movement. You look around the world and you see the lack of leadership, or as Jeff Steinberg's article says, this is a crisis from which Lyndon LaRouche will not shrink. So it's the same thing on the economy. If it wasn't for Lyndon LaRouche building this movement for a new Bretton Woods, which was adopted by the parliament of the country of Italy 10 days ago or so, and that's a G7, a group of seven countries, then I don't think the utopians would have any fear about this situation. They would just steamroll over all of the opposition and be in their war and, you know, get the blood out of the turnip that John Hoeffel's talking about. Okay, let's try and get another question in. Julian from Texas.
Hello. Yes, you hear me?
Okay, Julian, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I wanted to ask about the verifying that the Federal Reserve is controlling those banks, is how you could verify that and if it's even necessary. But the second one, more important, I want to understand, when I think about this floating exchange rate monetary system, I think about these biblical passages like varying weights, varying measures are an abomination. If you could explain some of the details of a floating exchange rate monetary system. Thanks.
John, go ahead.
Okay. In terms of whether or not the Fed has taken over the banks, you could call them up and ask them, they'll say no. You can ask the banks, they'll say no. I mean, you know, they lie like dogs. They wouldn't tell you the truth. They don't tell the truth about anything. Their balance sheets are fiction. Their press releases are fiction. It's all a lie. So I don't think you even need to prove it, because I think the proof is, if you look at the nature of the economy today and the way in which this enormous hole has been blown out of the markets, and that the reason why we had this bubble in the first place, the NASDAQ bubble and the telecom bubble, was because the banking system was bankrupt. In fact, these guys are gone. They've been gone for years. You know, and I think at this point it's official, but there are two sets of books. There's what they report to the Fed, and there's what they tell the public.
In other words, eventually we can find out that what's been going on with the government and with the banking is the same fakery that has been going on across the board. It's not one individual corporation, but everybody was following the same rules, right?
Yes. Yes. In terms of the floating exchange rates, this was implemented as part of the control disintegration. The purpose of floating exchange rates is it's much like the old mafia extortion racket, where you throw a brick through somebody's window and then you come around the next day and you offer them insurance against vandalism. That when you have fixed exchange rates, there's no need for a global derivatives market in foreign exchange. The rates are fixed. You don't have to hedge it. So what you do is you break down, you end the fixed rates, you then start manipulating the market, as they do frequently, to make the rates jump wildly. And then you turn around and say, oh, you need protection against these fluctuations. We'll sell you protection against these fluctuations. Trust us. But it's a mafia extortion racket. You want to stop it? You just stop it by going back to fixed exchange rates, and you don't need them anymore. This is why, one of the reasons why they're absolutely opposed to Lynn's new Bretton Woods plan, because it would put a whole big chunk of their looting apparatus right out of business.
Okay, there's a lot more to say on that dialogue, and Julian, you can stay on the conference call, organizers conference call, and pursue it. Right now, I think we're going to have a situation where we can't get to all of the questions, because we've been just joined by another guest I invited today to give us a crucial update on the Iraq War. We have Ed Spanas from Executive Intelligence Review, who is on the editorial board of EIR, and who is also the legal editor for EIR. Hi, Ed. How you doing?
Hi, Michelle. Thank you.
And Ed has just written an article for the upcoming EIR called Bush 41 Armed the Iraq, which Bush 43 Wants to Destroy. And that has some pretty indicting information in it about some of the worst chicken hawks. Remember what the chicken hawks are. They're the people who say, hell no, I didn't go to Vietnam, to Korea, to World War II, etc. And they're the worst warmongers in the administration. This is the nest of Israeli agents around Wolfowitz, Pearl, Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, and Dick Cheney himself, another war hawk who never fought for the United States in the military. Now, before we go to the scandal about, to put it as the Richmond Times Dispatch did this week, U.S. gave germs to Iraq, there's another important thing. Lynn has said that the United Nations should regard President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney as insane, clinically insane, because no President of the United States would ever take the positions against international law that they have taken. Why don't we go into this whole question? It is the United States, which is a rogue state.
Yeah, what Lyndon LaRouche said was that it's impossible to explain what President Bush and, for that matter, Vice President Cheney as well, are doing right now, except that they are insane, clinically insane, that they are violating the fundamental principles of international law, particularly those which the entire international system has been based upon since the end of World War II, and which the United States itself was key in establishing and implementing. And for example, the Nuremberg tribunals, the major war crimes trials at Nuremberg, the second count of that indictment was waging aggressive war. And of the 12 defendants in that trial, seven were convicted. All 12 were convicted on that. Seven were sentenced to hang and were hung for waging aggressive war. And now you have a president of the United States who is advocating, and in fact is beginning already, to do the same thing.
So that's the UN side of it. I understand that Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, who is not afraid of re-election, I guess he's been re-elected so many times, but he made the point that the congressional resolution is not constitutional either. So I didn't read that myself. If you have anything to say about Byrd and where that stands, I think that would be interesting. Well, and he confronted Rumsfeld, right. Too, right?
Yes, he did. Yeah. On the first point, I mean, he is making the point, and really more strongly than anybody else. It's sort of, but he has sort of emerged as the, I mean, he is the dean of the Senate. He's the longest, has the most seniority, I guess, of anybody there. But he is really emerged as a real statesman in this. And he is making the point that only under the Constitution, only Congress can declare war. And what this so-called use of force resolution does, it tries to have it both ways. It tries to give Congress a voice, but they're basically giving the president the power to launch war. This is not defending against an attack. I mean, no one disagrees that if the United States were attacked, the president can respond, right? But here we've not been attacked. There's no imminent threat of attack.
And no one else has been attacked.
Yeah, and no one else has been attacked. And so they're giving the same to the president, giving him a blank check. Whenever you feel like it, you can launch war. And by the way, maybe, you know, within 60 days or something, you should let us know that you've done this. And so Byrd is really calling the question on this. On the second point, on the chemical and biological weapons, and which were materials for which were supplied to Iraq during the 1980s, this was the Reagan administration and the Bush one, or Bush 41, as he's called, his administration, particularly in the Reagan administration, when George Bush Sr. was vice president. He was the point man in that administration for opening up relations with Saddam Hussein's Iraq and intervening with the Exim Bank to provide credits to them. And then sort of covertly, there were a lot of other things done, but openly, with the Commerce Department licensing, there were a lot of materials that could be and were used then for chemical and biological weapons. Now, a lot of this is totally legitimate. It was used for medical research. I mean, Iraq, of course, was the most technologically developed country in the Middle East. It had a public health program. They developed vaccines. I mean, all that was destroyed along with the weapons programs. But what Senator Byrd has done has been, he was the only senator with the courage to confront Rumsfeld after this Newsweek article came out about 2-3 weeks ago. He read parts of the article and asked Rumsfeld, because the article described Rumsfeld going to Baghdad in December 1983 and then again in March 1984, the first time meeting Tariq Aziz, then going and meeting Saddam Hussein himself, right? Opening up U.S. relations with them. And then after Rumsfeld was there is when all the arms, munitions, the chemical, biological stuff, all the stuff started going to Iraq. So Byrd did the obvious thing. He asked Rumsfeld about this article, which was on the cover of Newsweek on every newsstand in the country. And Rumsfeld did have to acknowledge that, yes, he had gone there. Yes, he had met Tariq Aziz. Yes, he had met Saddam Hussein. But I just don't know anything about all this other stuff you're talking about.
I got an email from an organization, which is the Organization of Gulf War Veterans, that is the Veterans of Desert Storm. And it looks like, you know, the LaRouche intervention with our 7 million leaflets against the Iraq war that we have been putting out since July has penetrated, you know, in their thinking, too, because they raised the question of, first of all, these are the Gulf War veterans. This is the Desert Storm, you know, Bush 41 veterans, and they absolutely oppose the preemptive war doctrine. And they say that Rumsfeld should be fired immediately because they quote him saying he has no knowledge that the United States ever supplied any of these toxins or chemical and biological agents. And he said he doubted that that ever occurred. And what they say is just on the basis of his ignorance. Right. This is a dangerous man to be in the position of defense secretary. Now, what evidence do we actually have in hand, and have you put into the EIR in this coming week about what went on?
Well, the best the best set of documentation were the hearings that took place in the Senate Banking Committee under Senators Riegel and D'Amato in 1994, and they issued a report in 1995. And this material, Byrd has again put into the congressional record, and in fact, even has it on his website. In fact, my wife, Nancy, just called to my attention. If you look, go to Senator Byrd's homepage, right on his homepage of his website, he has a picture of chemical and biological weapons that were found in Iraq by inspectors in 1991-92. And he says that Byrd has highlighted documents showing that the United States provided Iraq with the building blocks for its biological weapons program. And then he has a link into various speeches he's given on this. What those hearings documented, and this was this has been documented a number of places since then, and again, he put it in the record. You can get at it very simply by going to Senator Byrd's website, is lists documentation from the Centers for Disease Control showing, I believe it's over 70 shipments of various materials involving biological cultures, things of this sort. I mean, it's anthrax, botulism, equivalent of sarin gas, all kinds of stuff, which was sent there in the period from 1985 to 1989. There's also a private company called American Type Culture Corporation or something like that, which also had provided documentation that they provide biological cultures for medical research and things like this, that they had sent that stuff there as well. So this is, it's very, very well documented for anyone who's really paying attention at all, anyone who wants to find out. And the idea that Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, who went to Baghdad himself in 1993 and 1984, has no idea about this is preposterous. I mean, the Gulf War veterans are absolutely right on that. If the guy's either lying or he's so stupid, he shouldn't be there anymore. He shouldn't be. He doesn't remember what he did 20 years ago.
Okay, we know who Donald Rumsfeld, who's running the Pentagon, the Likudniks in the Pentagon, who are the worst kind of warmongers, i.e. those who have never been in a war, while the uniformed military people are warning caution. The next EIR, it also has an extraordinary article by Mr. LaRouche called A Boldly Modest Proposal, which we've been getting out in very wide coverage. Can you say a few words about Lynn's doctrine that answers the national security strategy that came from the White House?
Well, yeah, when Lynn got word of what the White House, Bush had put out, this so-called national security strategy document, he felt compelled to reply, and he replied, in fact, at great and substantial length, which is very important for everybody to read and master. I mean, one of the things he points out is that this comes from, as we've documented, there's nothing new about this. This was not triggered by September 11th. It was not triggered by any of the current thing that's happening currently. This is a doctrine that goes back to 1990, 1992, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Libby, and so forth, but actually goes back long before that into the H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell document, doctrine, rather, of their idea of a world order enforced by one sort of superpower empire. I mean, it goes back to the Roman Empire, everything of that sort. And what Lynn lays out in that is the origins and the doctrine of the nation state, the sovereign nation state. The Peace of Westphalia, where you had the first sort of codification, if you will, of the notion of the nation state, and how what Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Libby, these guys are promoting today, overturns all of that. It's a profound document, more than I can go into or explain right now, but everybody should get the new issue of EIR and study that, and that's the best sort of inoculation against this piece of nonsense that Bush has put out calling it a national security strategy.
Well, we've seen a certain amount fight coming out of the Democrats in Congress, largely because of what Lyndon LaRouche took on back in June when he identified the blackmail factor in organized crimes to candidates, Joe Lieberman and John McCain. And those were the two guys with Bush and Cheney at the White House this week saying they were going to deliver the Congress to this insane unconstitutional war resolution. So Lynn started the fight. I heard something in the briefing just today that Connie Morella, Republican congresswoman, she was being interviewed on NPR radio, and she said that out of 1,100 emails delivered to her by her own staff, every single one of them, 100% of the emails were against an aggressive, preemptive Iraq war. So there's something cooking in the Republican Party, too. Our movement really are the only ones that can bridge that gap and push forward this peace proposal. Let me just finish. We've got only 30 seconds left by announcing that next week, October 12th, our guest will be presidential candidate in 2004, Lyndon LaRouche. I hope you will all come back. We'll try to get to all the questions from the conference line, the organizer's conference call, and to the outside audience. This is Michelle Steinberg. You've been listening to the LaRouche Show with our guests John Hoeffel and Ed Spanis. Reach us at 1-888-347-3258.